Okay, so I'm going to tell you about, try to summarize some of the theory with regard to Stieltjes functions. And you have to understand that this is a, what I'm talking about is not a fully developed comprehensive mathematical theory. You know, the way, I don't know, the way Frobenius theory is completely worked out, this is sort of work in progress, and it's very difficult stuff. I mean, what I'm going to tell you is not difficult, but, you know, trying to get new results would be very impressive. If, by the way, you find this interesting and you decide to work on this, you know, this is a wide open field, and essentially any discoveries you make are going to be publishable. There's just incredible numbers of areas of things that you can investigate. Okay, so this is what I concluded with last time. Okay, I said, let's imagine we have a function w of x such with the property that it is positive for x greater than or equal to 0. Okay? And let's define the nth moment of this weight function to be the integral from 0 to infinity dx w of x x to the n. So that's just the definition of the letters A. Okay? Now, what I said was that a Stieltjes function is a function of the form f of x equals an integral from 0 to infinity dt w of t over 1 plus xt. Okay? That is a Stieltjes function. So if you come across a function, any function or other, and you could write it in this form. Okay, now writing it in that form is not good enough. You have to write it in this form, and you also have to show that the function up here vanishes at infinity so rapidly that all these moments exist. So you have to show that this function w is positive, and also all moments exist. Okay? So that is a Stieltjes function, something of that form. Okay? And a Stieltjes series is a series of the form sum from n equals 0 to infinity, a sub n minus 1 to the n, okay, times x to the n. Okay? And you can see that we can do a Borel sum, a sort of Borel sum, which is a generalized idea for Borel sum, because if we wanted to sum this series, what we would do would be, we'd say, all right, let's substitute in this formula for a sub n. That gives us the sum from n equals 0 to infinity. Okay, sum from n equals 0 to infinity. I replace a sub n by that integral from 0 to infinity, dt w of t x t to the n, and then there's a minus 1 to the n and an x to the n, okay? And then I illegally, okay, interchange orders of integration and summation, and I sum the series, you know, sum minus 1 to the n, x to the n, t to the n. That's just 1 over 1 plus xt. So that when I'm done, I have summed the series, and I get this function. Okay? Now, in what sense is interchanging this illegally? Well, it's illegal because it typically ends up in a divergent series. But in this class, and in general, this is not a problem. We just can't write an equal sign between these two things. What we have to write is an asymptotic sign. Okay. So the statement is that this integral here, well, let's write it up here. The statement is that this integral, 0 to infinity dt w of t over 1 plus xt, is asymptotic to the series a sub n minus 1 to the n x to the n, okay, in the limit as x goes to 0. Okay, now to be precise, it is asymptotic in the limit as x goes to 0 plus. Okay? And to be even more precise, this is a precise statement now, but in fact, this statement can be generalized. Here, we're talking about x goes to 0 plus, meaning that x, here's the x, the complex x plane, it means that we're approaching 0 in that direction. But in fact, you can approach 0 in all directions except along the negative axis. So this statement here, that statement can be generalized to read as absolute x goes to 0 with the argument of x. You know what that symbol means, complex argument. Okay, less than pi. So the argument of x ranges all the way down to minus pi and all the way up to plus pi, but it does not include the negative axis. So we are talking here about the cut plane. Okay, so what I'm saying, just in words, I'm saying that this function is represented by this asymptotic series as x, as absolute x, goes to 0 in the cut plane, in the cut plane. So in all directions except for one, and that's the negative axis. Okay. Now, so this is the way the theory. So if you have a Stieltjes function, you can immediately represent it by a Stieltjes series. And if you have a Stieltjes series, you can sum that series, and you can rewrite it as a Stieltjes function. Okay? So that, now, the question is, what are the properties of a Stieltjes function? Okay? Properties of f of x. Okay. So the first property of f of x is that f of x is analytic in the cut x plane, with a cut on the negative real axis. Okay, that's the first property. Okay, now, what I'm saying is that here is the complex x plane, here is a cut, and apart from the negative real axis, this function here, f of x, is analytic everywhere. Okay, the only place it's not analytic is on the negative real axis. Well, how do you show that? Yeah.
You show that it's like representable by Taylor series expansion afterwards.
That's true, but
or you
that's not easy to do that. Or we you can actually do that, but there's a faster way. Analytic means that it has a derivative. That's all. Okay? So I'm going to prove to you it has a derivative. Okay? To prove it to you, I'm going to differentiate it. That's all. Okay? So f prime of x is the integral from 0 to infinity dt w of t over 1 plus, that's 1, 1 plus xt squared. Okay? And then there's a minus sign and a factor of t. Okay? So that is the formula for the derivative. So, and this converges. This integral converges because w goes to 0 very rapidly because of this condition. Okay? So the derivative exists. And if a function has a derivative, a complex derivative, x is treated here as a complex variable. If the function has a complex derivative, then it's analytic. Okay? So that's the proof. That's one of the easy proofs. Okay? Okay, second property. Yeah?
Are we allowed to differentiate the integral?
Yes, because this integral here is absolutely and uniformly convergent.
On the whole infinite interval.
On the entire interval, for all x, except when x is a negative number. You can see why, right? You all see why. You all see what the problem is, right? If x happens to be a negative real number, then there's some value of t for which the denominator is 0. So apart from that, this integral is absolutely and uniformly convergent. There's no problem with that. The result of doing the differentiation produces an integral which, again, is absolutely and uniformly convergent. And so this is justified. So there's no problem with differentiating. Okay. All right. What's another property? Well, I've actually stated this already, but let me say it again. The second property is that f of x is asymptotic to the series a sub n, x to the n minus 1 to the n, as x goes to 0, and r x is less than pi. Okay? So f of x has this asymptotic series representation, and this representation is valid in all directions except along the negative axis. Okay? And this is a non-trivial result. This is very non-trivial. But it's not too hard to prove. I'm not going to bother to prove it here. But, you know, I gave you last time a definition for what it means for a function to be represented by an asymptotic series. And order term by term in that series, this satisfies that asymptotic, you know, that sequence of asymptotic relations. Remember, when you say a function is represented by an asymptotic series, you mean that you have an infinite number of asymptotic relations. Okay, and I defined an asymptotic relation. Okay, so there's another property. There are only four that are important. Another property is that as x goes to infinity, this function goes to 0. Okay, so f goes to 0 as x goes to infinity. And that's, again, pretty clear. Because if I take, let's say, as x goes to infinity in cut plane, and this is true because I can simply take x bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, and this function vanishes. Okay? The denominator goes to infinity. Okay. It's the last property that is very interesting, and this, I love this. Minus f of x is Herglotz. I love that word. Okay, so what does that mean? So a Herglotz function is a function whose imaginary part. So here's the definition. A Herglotz function has positive imaginary part in the upper half plane and negative imaginary part in the lower half plane. Okay? So in other words, another way to say that is the imaginary part of a Herglotz function has the same sign as the function of x as the imaginary part of x. Okay? So if the imaginary part of x is positive, then the imaginary part of f is positive, and the imaginary part of x is negative, then the imaginary part of f is negative. Okay, and that's it. Okay, so if you have a still cheese function, then it has these four properties. And it may have more properties that are interesting, but these are the crucial properties. Okay? You might say, so what? Because, you know, writing down a function and then finding its properties is not really all that interesting. Here's the interesting part. The interesting part is that if you have a function with these four properties, then it is a Stieltjes function. And that is a deep, deep theorem, and a very difficult theorem to prove. So the interesting part is if f of x has properties 1, you know, 1 through 4, then it is a Stieltjes function. And that's really, really important. Okay? So it's relatively straightforward to show that a Stieltjes function has these things. It is not trivial to show that if you have a function and you verified these four properties, then it is a function of Stieltjes. So I'm going to sort of indicate to you how you go about proving it, but this is not easy. This is not an easy proof. And I'm just going to show you the beginning of a proof. Okay, I'm not going to show you the full proof. So how do you begin? this is really non-trivial. So we begin by using property 1. Property 1 says the function is analytic in the cut plane. Good. Once you know a function is analytic, what do you know? What is the most important result once you know that a function is analytic? It has a Taylor series, but that Taylor series is derived from a more fundamental and more general property. It has a representation in the form of a Cauchy integral. Okay, the Cauchy integral formula is the fountainhead from which you derive everything else in the theory of complex variables. Okay, so what I mean is this. If you have a function f of x in the complex x plane, and it's analytic in this case except on the negative real axis, what that means is you can take some point over here, x. Let's call this the t-plane. Let's call that the t-plane. Here's a point x in the t-plane. What does the Cauchy integral theorem say? It says that f of x is equal to 1 over 2 pi I integral around a contour, okay, of f of t over t minus x dt, okay, where this contour encircles the point x. Okay? And this is a profound result. This is absolutely astonishing. There is no equivalent of this result, no equivalent whatsoever in the case of real variables. Just no result. You see what this is saying? This is saying that I can represent f of x, and I have separated x from the function. You see that x appears explicitly under the integral sign. And so I could do things like differentiate with respect to x and integrate with respect to x and get a new integral representation. This is a very, very profound result. Okay. So starting point of this argument is that f of x... Oh, actually, before I go on, I should just... I want to talk about this, because we didn't really spend any time on this. This is not obvious, but it's really, really easy to see. It's easy for me to show this to you. How do you show that f or minus f is a Hurkacz function? Well, it's easy. Just let x equal a plus ib. Okay? I'm just going to show you this explicitly, just straightforwardly. Let x equal a plus ib. Okay? Substitute that into this formula here. Just throw it into the formula. So you get f of x is equal to integral from 0 to infinity dt, f of t, or w of t, over 1 plus a plus ib t. I mean, it's just straightforward, right? And now, just for laughs, let me rationalize the denominator so that, you know, I'll multiply the top and the bottom by the complex conjugate of this. Okay, that's easy. So here is some complex number in the denominator. Let me multiply in the denominator by 1 plus a times t minus ibt, multiplied by the complex conjugate. Okay? And in the numerator, I then have 1 plus at minus ibt. Okay? And if I multiply out the denominator, what do I get? I get 1 plus at squared plus b squared t squared. That's the denominator. So now, this is really very easy. Let's take the imaginary part of the left hand of this integral. So the imaginary part of f is the thing that is proportional to I. Got it? So that is equal to minus b times the integral from 0 to infinity dt w of t times t, factor of t over here. And then in the denominator is 1 plus at squared plus b squared t squared. Okay? Okay, so now it's obvious, right? Because, look, this integral here, all of this junk, is a real positive number. T is real and positive. A, this is a square. This is a square. W is a positive thing. Everything is positive here. So what we've shown is that the sign of the imaginary part of f is opposite to the sign of b. But b is the imaginary part of x. So in the upper half plane, imaginary part of f is negative. In the lower half plane, imaginary part of f is positive. Yeah?
What you bring?
Hmm? No. Minus f.
Oh, sorry.
Minus f is Hurkacz. Okay, so we have this Hurkacz property. It's not clear, you know, this is a weird result. It's not clear that that is important. It turns out it is utterly crucial. Okay, this is a word that you rarely hear. If you take a course in complex variables, you know, the chances are 95% that you won't hear that word ever. But this is absolutely crucial for what I'm saying today. Yeah?
Is this related to the Euclidean path integral being well-defined?
No, it's not. It's a specific... No, it isn't. Because this is not in the form of this is not even in the form of the Euclidean path integral. It's interesting. There are connections. But it's not directly connected. I'll save after chat about it. Okay, so how do you show that if you can establish these four properties for a function, that that function happens to be a Stieltjes function. So what I said was, let's use the properties one at a time. So number one, f is analytic in the cut plane. All right. So that allows me to write down the Cauchy integral formula. Okay. Now it's analytic in the entire cut plane. So that means that I can push this contour around, right? Path independence. So I'm going to push the contour around until it's in the shape of a toilet seat. Okay? So it looks like this. So instead of this contour, I'm going to push it around so it goes like this. It comes up here and it goes around here and it goes like this and it goes like this. Okay? So it's a giant toilet seat. Okay? Like that. Okay, and here is x. That's the point x. So we pushed it out into a huge toilet seat. Okay, you have a question.
Do we care if x is 0? Or are we, is that not how?
Well, I'm going to keep x away from 0 because, so, but we can always let x approach 0. But in general here, I mean, you understand x equals 0 is the one case where everything here is trivial. Okay, because at x equals 0, this divergent series this divergent series is just a 0. And f of 0 is just by definition a 0. So we'll just consider x that lies away from the origin, just to be careful. Okay, you understand why there's a cut over here. Okay, it's a branch cut. All right. So now, step two. We've now used all of the information in property one. I can now use the information in property three because I can push this contour all the way off to infinity. Okay? Now, think about what happens. If I push this contour off to infinity, the denominator is vanishing like the radius, this. It vanishes like the radius. But the length of the path of integration is also proportional to the radius. I call this r, and I'm letting r go to infinity. Okay. So the length of the path is proportional to r. The denominator is roughly r as x goes to infinity. So those balance. But f is going to 0. At infinity. And since f goes to 0, it means that this integral goes to 0. Okay. Now, again, I'm using a fact that I assume you know, you've had a little bit of complex variables, you know that a complex integral f of z dz, if you have a function f of z dz and you have some integral, okay, and you want to put an upper bound on the integral, okay, this is less than or equal to the length of the path of integration, okay, and the maximum value of f on the contour. Okay? And so in our case, the length of the contour is 2 pi r. And the maximum value of f is the maximum value of this f of t, maximum value of f of t on that contour. And it's divided by r, approximately r. Okay, do you all see that? So this r cancels, but we had said that that f goes to 0 in the cut plane, so this goes to 0. Okay, so the integral along this part of the contour vanishes, and I could shrink the inner contour all the way down to the origin. Okay, so it just is a teeny-weeny contour like that. And there's no contribution coming from this little tiny epsilon loop at the origin. Why? Because we know that at the origin, the function is given by this asymptotic approximation. The function is approximately a0. And the length of the path is epsilon, right, the radius. So there's no contribution from that. So using numbers 1 and 3, the only thing that remains is this. We now know that f of x is equal to 1 over 2 pi I, okay, times an integral that goes from minus infinity up to zero. And then it goes from zero back down to minus infinity. Okay? So it's 1 over 2 pi I, integral from minus infinity to zero, dt over t minus x, times f of t plus, that is t along the upper part of the cut, minus f of t minus along the lower part of the cut. Okay? And this has a name. Does somebody know what this kind of formula is called? No? This is called the dispersion relation. This is used dispersion relations in all fields of physics, even things like optics. Okay, so now the next step is to argue that just above the cut and just below the cut, because we have a Herglotz function, okay, the imaginary part has changed sign. But the real part of the function is continuous. Okay? So this is a discontinuity, you can call it D, if you like, D of T. And it is pure imaginary. Because when we subtract the top and the bottom, so the bottom from the top here, okay, the real part of F cancels. It's the imaginary part that undergoes a jump across the cut. And so this is this we can write as I times the discontinuity. Okay? And so we can rewrite that integral. Let's see. Let's go somewhere. Over here. Yeah, let's go. Okay. So we can write this as f of x is the integral, is 1 over 2 pi. I've canceled off the factor of I. Okay? 1 over 2 pi times the integral from minus infinity to 0, dt over t minus x times d of t. Okay, we're getting this. And we're almost there. Hang on for 1 second. We're almost there. Now you notice that this is an integral from minus infinity to zero. So what I would like to do is to call t minus s, say. Okay? And now this is an integral from infinity up to zero, not minus infinity because I've changed the sign, 1 over 2 pi ds with a minus sign, over minus s minus x d of t. D of minus s. D of minus s. Yeah. Okay? Are we there? Okay. And finally, so all of these minus signs go away. And then the last thing I'm going to do is replace, let's make the change of variable s equals, say, 1 over r. Okay? So ds is equal to minus 1 over r squared dr. Okay? So this integral is now from, now, when s equals infinity, r is equal to 0. So this is an integral from 0 to infinity, and it's dr over r squared, the minus sign, d of minus s, or d of minus 1 over r, and then 1 over r plus x. We're okay. Okay? And the last thing is that I'm going to multiply through by r. So this can be rewritten as an integral from 0 to infinity, dr d of minus 1 over r, an additional factor of 1 over r, and some minus sign in here, and 1 plus xr. Okay? Now, if I were to call this W of R, I've proved that we have a Pergolot's function. Right? So I've got the form right. If I call this thing, call it W of R, this is now an integral representation that looks like a Pergolot's function. But we haven't proved it. We've just begun. What do we have to prove? We have to prove that the moments exist. And we have to prove, well, we have to prove two things. We have to prove that these moments exist for all n. And we have to prove that that function is a positive function. That's the non-trivial part. That's really hard.
So do you mean it's still shifts over Pergolot's?
Did I say, sorry, I used the word Pergolot. Sorry, Stieltjes. Yes, this is a Stieltjes function. Yeah, sorry. Sleep. Yeah, okay. So you understand, this is the beginning of the hard work. Now, how do we actually establish these two facts about this function W of R? That's hard. That takes 50 pages. Okay? And the way you prove it is to use the fact that minus f is Pergolot's. That's what this minus sign is doing in here. So we have to prove that minus f is Pergolot's. And we also have to prove that, and we have to use this fact over here. So we have to expand this function very carefully into an asymptotic series and require that that asymptotic series be valid in the cut plane. That's an enormous amount of work. Okay, that's huge. Okay. So I have merely set up the proof for you, but I'm not going to do it. This is specialized, and you can read it if you're interested. Okay? But that's how the proof begins. So if you have these four properties, then you know you have a function of Stieltjes. Okay, so until now, this has been very mathematical. It's been really mathematical. So now we have to get back to physics. Okay, and here's where the physics is. Okay, so let's suppose that you are a licensed quantum mechanic, okay? And someone, you know, comes to your office and says, I need you to find the eigenvalues of a Schrodinger equation, okay? And they write down some equation, minus d squared dx squared plus v of x plus epsilon w of x, or plus w of x, let's say. Y equals EY. Okay. And the guy says E times Y of X. And the guy says to you, would you please calculate the eigenvalues for me? And you say, well, that's a very hard problem, so I'm going to use perturbation theory. So I'm going to insert in here a small parameter epsilon. Okay? And that means that E is now a function of epsilon. Okay? But now I want to show you, we haven't talked about this yet, but now I want to show you what the properties of this function E are. Okay? And the most interesting property of E is that it is Pergolot's. Okay? How do you prove that? That's amazing if it's true. So let's just take this equation and multiply both sides of the equation, multiply it by y star of x. Okay? Just take the equation, multiply by y star. So the equation reads minus y star y prime prime plus v of x times y star plus epsilon w times y star equals e times y star. Okay? Now, let's take this and integrate it from minus infinity to infinity. We'll just integrate everything in sight. Minus infinity to infinity, minus infinity to infinity. Okay? And finally, over here, let's integrate by parts once. So if we integrate by parts, this thing can be written as the integral from minus infinity to infinity, y star prime times y prime. OK? Do you see where I'm going? What am I going to do next? It's almost straightforward. What am I going to do? How about taking the imaginary part of this equation? OK? Notice, this thing is real. It's y prime times y prime star. Okay? And this is real. Okay? And this is real. And furthermore, if W is a positive potential, if it's a rising potential, it's real and positive. Okay? If it's not, I can just add a constant to it. Okay? And this is real and positive. Okay? Therefore, what I've shown you is that the imaginary part of epsilon times a real positive number here is equal to the imaginary part of e of epsilon times some real positive number over here. Therefore, the sine of epsilon is the same as the sine of the imaginary part of epsilon is the same as the sine of the imaginary part of e. Okay? So if you're solving an eigenvalue problem, you know that the energy is a Herglotz function of the perturbation parameter. That's really interesting. So this is a Herglotz function of epsilon. No one ever points this out in a quantum mechanics class, but it is. Okay? How would you like to see, let me just take a short maybe I should just make it. That was the fancy thing. It is, again, hard work, but it is rigorously true, proved true, that not only that, E of epsilon is analytic. You can establish analyticity properties. You can establish that the perturbation series, you know, E of epsilon is A sub n epsilon to the n, that this is an asymptotic series as epsilon goes to 0 in the cut plane. You could prove all four properties, okay? And they have been proved. And I'm not going to go through the proof. I'm not going to discuss it. But you can prove that this is true, say, for if this is x squared and this is epsilon x to the fourth. And in general, for a quantum field theory-like structure, this is analytic, and you have this property, okay? Yeah?
So you're saying that E is a Stieltjes function of epsilon?
Right.
And for a very large class of potentials and perturbations.
Right. And we know that. So this tells us that E of epsilon is Stieltjes. Okay? And that is the thing that we are looking for. Okay? So this is the reason why, I mean, until now I've been talking about mathematics, and that's dry to me. So I find that boring unless it turns out to be useful. And boy, is this useful, because E is a Stieltjes function. Yeah?
So you said that it's minus f is
Herbalox.
Right, so and minus E is Herbalox.
And here you were showing
that E is Herbalox. So it's really minus E is Herbalox. But we never care about an overall minus sum because it's either. So for a Stieltjes function, minus F is Herglotz. So E minus, technically speaking, minus E is the Herglotz function that we're looking for. Okay. So at the I don't like to just prove random theorems about mathematics because I'm not a mathematician. I don't find that fascinating. But I do want to show you one very, very cute theorem, which is actually relevant to us. Okay? And what I want to prove to you is that suppose you had a problem like this. I want to prove to you that if you solve this problem as a perturbation series, the radius of convergence of this perturbation series right here cannot be infinity. Okay? It has to be finite. It may be zero, but it cannot be infinity. So E of epsilon cannot be analytic everywhere. It's impossible. Okay? And this is a very, very cute proof. So I do want to show it to you because it's short and it's cute. Okay? So the only fact I'm going to use is that E of epsilon, we showed that it's Herglotz. Okay? So the question is, suppose, just in general, suppose you have f of z is a complex function. Suppose f of z is entire. Okay, what does entire mean? Analytic everywhere. Analytic everywhere. Okay, no singularities. Okay, I'm going to prove to you that there are singularities. Okay, suppose it's entire and Herglotz. What do we know about it? Okay. Well, you've seen that's nice. You've seen a theorem like this. So, can you tell me the name of the theorem? Do you remember? Liouville's theorem. That's right. What does Liouville's theorem say? That's right. So, if you have a function that has no singularities, it's entire in the finite plane. No singularities in the finite plane. And it's bounded, then automatically, it's a constant. And from that, what is the usual next step? What do we show from that? Do you know? This is a classic next. Yes, what were you going to say?
The fundamental theorem of algebra.
Say, I didn't hear.
The fundamental theorem of algebra.
Of algebra, that's right. Because from that, it's a few steps to establishing the fundamental theorem of algebra, namely that if you have a polynomial, it has to have roots, which are complex numbers. Okay, factors into n roots. Okay, and that comes automatically from complex variables. If you try to prove that theorem without using complex variables, God, is that awful. It's just horrendous. But using complex variables, bang, just like that. Okay, so what you do, the way you prove the theorem is you say, suppose the function has no zeros. There are no roots. You have to prove, so you have a polynomial, suppose it has no roots. Okay? Then 1 over that polynomial has no zeros in the denominator, and therefore it's bounded. And because there are no zeros in the denominator, it's analytic. So we have a bounded analytic function. So that polynomial has to be a constant. Contradiction. So there must be a zero. If there's a zero, you can divide it out and get a polynomial of degree n minus 1 and continue the process, and so it has n roots. Just like that. It's wonderful. It's a wonderful proof. Okay. So suppose, but this is like the theorem, and you remember Liouville's theorem. This is very much like the theorem. Suppose we have a function which is entire and Herglotz. What do we know? Well, if it's entire, we know that f of z has a Taylor series. F of z can be written as the sum from n equals 0 to infinity, a sub n, z to the n. Okay? And furthermore, z is r e to the I theta. in polar coordinates. So I could rewrite this as the sum from n equals 0 to infinity, a sub n, r to the n, e to the I n theta. Okay? Now, if this function is Herglotz, then these coefficients have to be real. Okay? Those functions, those numbers, a sub n, have to be real, because on the real axis, the function has to be real. Okay? So therefore, what do we know? If we take the imaginary part of both sides, we know that the imaginary part of f of z is the sum from n equals 0 to infinity, a sub n, r to the n, sine of n theta. And in fact, there is no n equals 0 term in this series. So this is really n equals 1. Aha! This reminds us of what we were talking about a week ago, or a week and a half ago, right? That is a Fourier series. Okay? Now, I'm going to use one very simple fact. Suppose you have sine of theta, where theta is between 0 and pi. Okay? You know what sine of theta looks like. It looks like this. Here's pi. It goes like that. Okay? Now, here's an interesting fact. If you multiply sine theta by an integer n, so that now the picture looks like this, this has exactly the same sign, okay, has same sign as n sine of theta plus or minus sine of n theta. Okay? If you add or subtract sine of n theta, you cannot change the sign of n sine of theta. Okay? So therefore, so here is the imaginary part of f of z. And we are told that it's Herglotz. Okay? So therefore, this has the same sign, this guy has the same sign as sine of theta. Has the same sign as sine of theta, because sine of theta is the imaginary part of z. But sine of theta has the same sign as n sine of theta plus or minus sine of n theta. Got that? So therefore, if I multiply on the left and on the right by sine of theta, on the left I'll have here sine squared of theta, which is positive. Okay, left-hand side will be positive. On the right-hand side, I will have the sum from n equals 1 to infinity, a sub n, r to the n, sine of n theta, and I'm multiplying by n sine of theta plus or minus sine of n theta. And the last step is to integrate this. Let's just integrate this from 0 to pi. Okay? Now, what is going to happen? I have orthogonality. Right? So the only thing that will remain on the right-hand side is the n equals 1 term and the n equals n term. That's the only thing that will... Oh, this is very bad. I apologize. This is m. Okay, m. Okay. Doesn't matter. Okay, so I'm going to integrate with respect to theta, and that integral will pick out the nth term, right? So there will only be two terms on the right-hand side left over. So what we know is that the left-hand side of this equation is positive, and the right-hand side of this equation, the zeroth term, the n equals 1 term will come from here. And I'll have an a1 times r times some factor of pi over 2 times n, doesn't matter, okay? The second term will be plus or minus an r to the n times pi over 2 again. Now you see there's a contradiction, okay? Because how could this be positive always? I could choose r so big that I could make this either positive or negative. No matter how big this term is, that term can always be, I can choose an r so big that the sign is not positive. Got that? So therefore, what do I conclude? Now I have a contradiction, unless something is true. Well, unless A sub n equals 0 for n greater than 1. And so therefore, I conclude that if f of z is entire and Herglotz, that implies that it is linear, because all the higher terms in its Taylor series can't be there. So it just has the form a plus bz. That's all. Okay. So, suppose you are doing perturbation theory. You know that if you are doing perturbation theory and you calculate the first term in the perturbation series, A0, and then A1 epsilon, and A2 epsilon squared, right there, A2 epsilon squared, that function is not linear. Therefore, it must have singularities. It cannot be entire. That's why we know there are singularities in the complex epsilon plane. That's very beautiful, very beautiful. That's a side issue, but it's very beautiful. Okay, now we get to the climax of this lecture. Okay, yeah.
But E of epsilon is not analytic.
E of epsilon cannot be analytic, cannot be an entire function, except in utterly trivial cases where this is a linear perturbation series. Just the series truncates and just has the form A plus B epsilon.
Yes. Does this have any effect on a thing that we did quite a long time ago where it'll analytically continue the energies?
Yeah. Those are the singularities that must be present in the finite epsilon plane. Those are the singularities.
The singularities.
So they must be there. We didn't prove that those same. This doesn't prove that the singularities are square root singularities, which is what I claimed they were. That's very, very hard to prove. That's really hard to prove. People are still writing papers on that now. That's really hard to prove. But we do know there are singularities. That's what this shows. Okay. All right. Yeah.
The equality over there, sine squared theta, the second to last line, that's just an equality of sine, right?
Where is it?
The same sine.
Which one? This one? The n sine of theta has the same sine.
That's equation there.
Oh, no, it just means, it's not an equality, it just means same sine.
Yeah.
Okay. So, which we know is positive. Okay. So now we get to the point of all this. Remember, you are a licensed quantum mechanic. Guy has come into your office and has written down a Schrodinger equation. Okay, and he wants you to find the eigenvalues. And it's a very, very hard problem, so you can only solve it using perturbation theory. So you insert an epsilon. But you know that as soon as you insert an epsilon, E becomes a function of epsilon. But E of epsilon has all four properties of a Stieltjes function, and therefore E of epsilon is a Stieltjes function. So what? Okay, so what? This is the work, this is the really fundamental work, and I'm not going to prove any of it to you, but I'm just going to state it. If you have a Stieltjes function, f of z, which is given by this Stilgi series, a sub n z to the n. And if you construct the pod a's from this series, pnn of z and pn n plus 1 of z, if you construct those pod a's, okay, for a Stilgi's function, then it is a rigorously true fact that these pod a's converge, each of these, as n, this converges to some limit, say L upper, this converges to some limit, L lower, or something like that. Everywhere, for all z in the cut plane. Okay? That's a beautiful, beautiful result. It is a very deep and interesting result. And what it says is that even though this series here is divergent, if you construct the pod a's, it is rigorously guaranteed that this sequence of pod a's converges to some limit, we call this L1, okay? And this sequence converges to some limit, L2. And in particular, on the real axis, so here, for real z, for z real, so here's the, this is the real z axis. If you make a plot, not the real z axis, this is for real z, okay? And you make a plot of pnn as a function of n, what does it do? It is a monotone sequence that converges to a limit like that. Always. And it always converges downward to a limit. Always. Okay? And this limit is called L1. Okay? And if you construct pnn plus 1, then this is a sequence of pod a approximants, and they converge to some limit, L2. Okay? The problem is that L1 may not be equal to L2. Is there any way to guarantee that L1 equals L2? And the answer is, finally, this is the last point of this whole course. The final point is that L1... And the correct value of E that we're trying to calculate lies between L2 and L1. It's less than L1, and it's greater than L2. That is rigorously true. Okay? But the question is, you know, E is somewhere in between here, but we still don't know E uniquely. Is there a way to determine E uniquely? And the answer is yes. And this is condition 5, okay, which we could call, you know, there are the four, it's like quintessence, right? What is you know, there are the four, Aristotle had the four humors and the four elements and four, everything was four of everything, right? SU4, something. But there was quintessence. That's the fifth property, okay? So here's the fifth property, property 5, and it's called, it has a name, and it's called I love that name, Carloman, because for some reason. All right, so the Carloman condition says, okay, L1 equals L2 always if there is a unique solution to the moment problem. And we have talked about this before. We've mentioned this in class. What is the moment problem? The moment problem is you give me a set of A sub n's, and you tell me that A sub n is equal to the integral from 0 to w, 0 to infinity w times x to the n dx. Okay? A unique solution to the moment problem means, that is, there is a unique w. Okay? So that's the issue. If there is a unique solution to the moment problem, you look at these numbers, a1, a2, a3, a4, you write them down and you say, ha, there's only one w that satisfies that equation. If that's true, then there is a unique answer. The pades converge to a unique answer. So is there anything that will guarantee that there's a unique solution? And this is a problem that has been studied and studied. It's a very, very, very interesting problem. It is not solved. Nobody knows a complete answer to this problem. But there is a nice, simple condition, and that is the Carloman condition. And what Carloman showed was that if A sub n grows no faster than 2n factorial, then there's a unique solution to the moment problem. Okay? And so if you know that when you do perturbation theory, if you know that as n goes to infinity, so as n goes to infinity, how fast do these perturbation coefficients grow? You know, E of epsilon is A sub n epsilon to the n. E of epsilon is that. If you know, for example, and we do, that A sub n for large n grows like a constant to the n times n factorial, bingo, you have satisfied the moment condition, and there is a unique solution to the problem. Why is this n factorial? The simple answer, this is not an obvious answer, but the simple, straightforward answer is that there are about n factorial graphs in phi to the 4 theory. And so, since there are n factorial graphs, roughly speaking, there's an average graph. You have to show that, but there's an average graph. You multiply the average graph by the number of graphs, and you conclude that the nth term in the perturbation series grows like n factorial. Ha! That means that it satisfies the Carloman condition, because Carloman says 2n factorial. If you had a phi to the 6th theory, if you had here x to the 6th, then in this case, a sub n for x to the 6th, a sub n would grow like 2n factorial. So we can solve a phi to the 6th theory as well. But if you had x to the 8th here, for x to the 8th, a sub n grows like 3n factorial. Uh-oh. And indeed, if you calculate the pades, what they do is one sequence of pades goes like that, and the other sequence of pades goes like that. And the correct answer is right in between those two. That's where the correct answer is. So we have a problem. Okay, and there are techniques for summing the series. They're sort of ad hoc techniques. Okay, so let's see. I want to show you one thing, which will take just the last 5 minutes, because this is very, very interesting. But are there any questions? This is the, I have summarized basically everything that is known about how to solve quantum problems using perturbation theory from beginning to end. Okay? Showed you what perturbation theory was. I showed you how to develop a perturbation series, how to calculate it by iterating the Schrodinger equation or by Feynman diagrams, whatever. I showed you that the perturbation theory diverges, but I've given you a set of, this is what is known about the theory that says that you can sum up the perturbation series and get exactly the right answer. Okay? Yeah.
It's not obvious to me what those moments are, what those, the weight functions are, and what a weight function would be for a particular problem, and if it would have any significance, physical significance? Is that
yes, it does. And that was what I was going to show you in the last 5 minutes. It's a really... let me just a comment. Just make a comment. This is what I... in fact, those, I believe, also, the off-diagonal pot, you know, like Pn, n plus 7, those also converge. Okay, so Pn, n plus a for fixed a also converges. Okay, but it doesn't converge. These all converge to different limits unless you've met the Carloman condition, in which case they all converge to the same limit. Okay. However, I don't know about, you know, things like Pn, 2n, things like that. I don't know what the conditions are. So long as you're on a diagonal, you could be, you know, a units higher than the diagonal or below the diagonal. Okay. Those all converge. But if you go along some other diagonal, you know, some, this is not in the diagonal direction. Okay. I don't know what the conditions are. We can look that up. Okay, that's an interesting question. I don't know what happens. Okay. Yeah. No, we can still do perturbation theory for phi to the eighth. But if we just do straightforward, I'll tell you. If you just do straightforward pod A, it's not going to tell you uniquely what the eigenvalues are. It'll give you an upper or lower bound on them, but it won't tell you what they are. Okay, so what do you do? Well, basically what you try to do is an approximate Borel sum. Because you can still show that that theory is a Borel summable, that expansion is a Borel summable expansion. And so you have to do a powerful enough Borel. You have to do a Borel multiple times to get enough factorials out of the, you know, if the nth term in the series is growing like 3n factorial, each time you do Borel, you kill an n factorial. But so you've got to do that 3 times. And also, you only know a finite number of terms in the series. Nah. Okay? So you have to get an approximate Borel function and then integrate that function from 0 to infinity. And that works, but it's quite messy. It's not easy to do that.
And this is still infinite.
Yeah, this has nothing to do. This is a generally true fact about perturbation theory. So this need not, this could be field theory. This need not be the Schrodinger equation. So I will just show you something about uniqueness here. For example, suppose A sub n is 8n plus 7 factorial. Just suppose it is. Okay, that violates the Carloman condition. So given that it violates the Carloman condition, there is not a unique solution to the moment problem. And I'm going to show you how non-unique the solution is. W of x equals e to the minus x to the 1/8 over 8 works. That is one solution to the moment problem. Okay? But another solution to the moment problem is a e to the minus x to the 1/4 sine of x to the 1/4. Where a is a number, and if a lies between 1.21584 and minus 0.14761, okay, all of these w's satisfy the moment problem for these coefficients a. That's an example of a non-unique solution. So there's a continuously infinite number of solutions to the moment problem. So this is really subtle. This is really tricky. Okay, but you could verify, just as an exercise, you could verify that this easily works, and it gives you 8n plus 7 factorial, and that if you add this, the moments of this are 0. So they don't change these moments. Okay? Yeah?
Are those the Stoche's ghost functions?
Stoche's ghost functions.
These are functions whose all those moments vanish.
All those moments vanish. That's called the Stoche's ghost function. Yeah. So this is an example of such a function. All the moments of this function vanish. But you see, this is not positive. You could see that this is not a positive function. So we exclude that. But if A lies between that and that, it does not screw up the positivity, because this is positive enough so that even though this could have positive sign or negative sign, it doesn't matter. Okay? Yeah?
Condition is one-sided, right? It means that if it grows no faster than 2n factorial, then it's guaranteed.
Then it guarantees.
But is it the other way, that if it grows faster?
If it grows faster than 2n factorial, it does not imply that there is a non-unique solution.
But it might have.
But it might have a non-unique solution, and we don't know. So you have to investigate each case.
So when we see this hn plus 7 factorial, we cannot readily say that. Oh, this will.
We don't know that it's non-unique. But here I've just proved to you by construction that the solution is not unique. Okay. So one last comment, and you asked, what is the physical meaning of the weight function? And I'm going to show you that. And that's very quick. And it's essentially right here on the board. Okay? So let's see. I need just the next equation that we wrote down after that. So you remember that we showed that we have this thing is called the dispersion relation. And if we go to this, so D is the imaginary part of the energy. If we're talking now about physics, that's the imaginary part of the energy. Okay? And these I's cancel. So all I'm going, and this is the energy evaluated at T, which is running from minus infinity to 0. So all I need to do is to say, let me replace T by minus T. Okay? So this is the energy as a function of x. The energy as a function of x, or we usually calculate it as function of epsilon, is 1 over 2 pi times the integral from infinity down to 0, because I've changed the sign of T, and I have minus dt over minus t, so all that cancels. And I have dt over t plus epsilon. And I have the imaginary part of the energy as a function of epsilon. Okay? Everybody see that? And it's because I've changed the sign, this is not epsilon, t. Okay, and it's now minus t. Okay? So I can write this as the integral from 0 to infinity and put in another factor of minus. Okay? Now, you see, there is a 1 over t plus epsilon. I can write 1 over t plus epsilon as 1 over t times 1 plus epsilon over t, which I can then write as 1 over t times the sum epsilon to the n over t to the n times minus 1 to the n. Do you all see that? Just expand it out. So I have a series in powers of epsilon. But remember, we have also calculated on the left side of this equation E, which is a series in powers of epsilon. Okay? But asymptotic series are unique. Therefore, we know that A sub n, the nth term in the perturbation series, is equal to 1 over 2 pi times the integral from 0 to infinity minus sine dt over t to the n plus 1 times, and there's a minus 1 to the n, minus 1 to the n, times the imaginary part of e of minus t. That's an equality. And this is the weight function, or related to the weight function. What is that? What is that? So I'll just conclude with that. This, what is the imaginary part of the energy for negative t? T, remember, t is the coupling constant. If I had a potential like v of x is x squared plus epsilon x to the fourth, you know, plus epsilon w, this potential looks like this. When epsilon is positive, it looks like this. But here, we're evaluating it for negative argument. T is epsilon. Okay? So the potential looks like this. Here, there are energy levels. Here, the energy levels do not exist. And that's because if you put a particle in this potential well, the particle tunnels and goes out to infinity. So we have an unstable problem. What is the imaginary part of the energy for an unstable problem? It's a function of minus t, upside down potential. What is that? It's the imaginary part of the energy is 1 over the lifetime of the state. Remember, you know, Heisenberg uncertainty principle, delta E, delta T is 1. Right, approximately 1. So this is the lifetime of the state in this potential well. So what is the meaning of this weight function over here? It is related to the lifetime of the state if I turn the potential upside down. Not the original potential, but a different potential which has been turned upside down. And we've been led to that potential by doing this analytic continuation and constructing the dispersion relation. Okay? So, if we want to see whether or not the Carloman condition is satisfied, we have to let n go to infinity. And if we let n go to infinity, how is this integral dominated? It's dominated by what is happening right near zero. So if you take the coupling very, very weak, and you calculate the lifetime of the state, what does this potential look like if the coupling is very weak? It looks like this. It goes up forever. But after this very, very weak coupling, eventually it turns around. So this is an almost stable state. Do you see what I've derived here? This is Hawking radiation. This is a black hole. Particles are tunneling out to infinity. It's precisely the physics that we're describing here. And what I've shown you is that the nth term in perturbation theory is the nth inverse moment of the lifetime of the state. And I can calculate that using WKB theory. Okay, you've learned about tunneling. Presumably you've studied tunneling and WKB. So WKB theory gives me the behavior of a sub n as n goes to infinity, and that's how I verify the Carloman condition. Okay, so this is a whole area of study in physics. It's an absolutely fascinating study. It's called the large order behavior of perturbation theory. Okay, and it is really a measure. It is a semi-classical study, and it is a measure of the lifetime. It involves measuring the lifetime of an unstable state that you get by changing the sign of the perturbation parameter, epsilon, changing epsilon to negative epsilon. Okay? So calculating the energy for negative argument, not for positive argument, for negative argument. Okay? So that's how you verify. And that is the complete, that is where the theory is now. Okay? So you can calculate this. So I know exactly, when I do this integral here, I know exactly that a sub n for an x squared plus epsilon x to the fourth theory, I know that a sub n is exactly asymptotic to n factorial times 3 to the n. I know this result precisely. I know that constant. Okay? So that does it. Okay? I hope you found this interesting. Okay? Sorry.
Showing us what is actually there at the cutting edge of applied mathematics,
yeah.
And also to kind of give us a sense of excitement about quantum mechanics and quantum field theory, that these things are not complete subjects, but there are still things to be discovered,
yeah.
At the foundational level. So as a token of our gratitude, I'd like to present you with the PSI 2011 shirt. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you.